So we have a website. And the few papers that were here, I had only five copies. I had 12 on Saturday, and it was the introductory lecture. And that is already posted on the website. So there's really no need to have that paper with you unless you don't have easy access to the internet. So if you go to Brown University of HumanUnity.org, it's been used quite a lot now, so it comes up easily. And I opened two groups that you should be able to access directly. There is the Philosophy of Evolution group, and there's the Poetry of Sri Aurobindo group. So my intention is to post there relevant papers and texts as far as possible. I have some, I've been pursuing this study for a long time, and I have a lot of books that are not online or easily available, so I can photocopy that from those sources and bring those here to the meetings. But as much of it as I can put on the website, I will. And in a group forum on our website, it's easy for you also to post papers, documents, comments, to comment on whatever is there. And so we're hoping to develop this website as a supplement to our courses, so that we can save some, perhaps not save, but economize on time and space, and have communication going on other than just during these sessions once a week. So let's see how that goes. We haven't tried that yet. It's an experiment for us to explore the use of the website in this context. Our whole session, our series of sessions, which we did last year, the first semester, we met on Saturdays for about 6 months. And every Saturday there was a presentation and a discussion. And in the context of those, there were papers posted. So there are about 50 or 60 papers from that period of time, plus maybe 30 audio files of presentations and discussions. So all of that should be accessible to everyone. And one of the purposes of this session is to begin to create an archive of explorations like these, which we will refine and make available to whomever wishes to see what we're doing, hear what we're doing. So on Saturday I gave an introduction that most of you didn't hear, and I'll repeat some of that this morning, this afternoon, and it's in that paper. Did anybody not get a paper who doesn't have access to the website, who would need to get a copy?
It's not
anything that, there's nothing there that's not going to be said fairly easily here now. The essence of it is going to be stated. Let's just look briefly for a moment at these statements. The first two statements are definitions of philosophy taken from Encyclopedia Britannica 2007, which, by the way, if you have that, if you have access to that on your computer, it's an extraordinary resource in every subject area. But there's one paper that I have made from the encyclopedia that I was thinking of distributing
to those who don't have access to it, and that may be a large number of us. Jose Ayala at Harvard has written for Encyclopedia Britannica recently the very best summary of the science of evolution that exists. And it's 90, I have made a 92-page download of that article, which is longer than that because I didn't download all of the illustrations and everything. But I can print out this 92-page document quite easily and make it available here next time for continuous reference. It's invaluable as far as the science of evolution goes. And I think we would be referring to it periodically. So, who has access to Encyclopedia Britannica 2007 on their computers?
Okay.
Someone gave it to me, and I've installed it on all of our school computers. Anyway, this is a document that's probably worth having in hand because it's so long that, you know, sitting in front of your computer and going through it again and again can get to be monotonous. So I think it's a valuable thing to have in hand. And there are a number of other documents like that that I think will be valuable for this exploration. So as I said on Saturday, we could easily invest 500 rupees each for hard copies of texts. I have the early editions of Herbert Spencer, for example, and I'm going to be referring to that text. But there are some things from that text that it's worth dwelling upon. And similarly, I have early editions of Haeckel's volumes of biological and philosophical works. So for some of those things, and Bergson also, if we want to look at them more in depth, it's good to have hard copies of some of the chapters of their works. So I foresee easily producing 500 rupees worth of copies, which can't really be uploaded very easily. So, philosophy is the critical examination of the grounds for fundamental beliefs and analysis of the basic concepts employed in the in their expression. This, at least, I think, is one good definition of what philosophy means. The philosophy of nature, particularly, is the exploration of, I put in quotes, the features of natural reality and their implication for metaphysics, or theory of reality, or one's worldview, for anthropology, for ethics, and so on. What are the features of natural reality that we base our general theories upon? How do we arrive at an understanding of those features? Is a subtext of philosophy. And then we come to a quote from Alfred North Whitehead. "The assemblage of philosophic ideas is more than a specialist study. It molds our type of civilization." It's important to note, I think, that in both the intuitive spiritual direction of mental development and the scientific and analytical direction of mental development, especially in the last 150 years, the idea of evolution has been very prominent. And it continues to be more and more prominent. The ideas of evolution were fundamental to Sri Aurobindo's philosophy and yoga. In the publication called The Supramental Manifestation and Other Writings, there are hundreds of pages dwelling on the topic of evolution. And not just the spiritual view of evolution, but also there are detailed discussions of the scientific view of evolution. There are extensive commentaries on the theory of natural selection. And when Sri Aurobindo was a student in London and at Cambridge, Spencer published his Synthetic Philosophy, and it became a very popularly read treatise. It was published around 1859, and it was a precursor to The Origin of Species. And at that time that Sri Aurobindo was there, T.H. Huxley was the president of the Royal Society. And he was publishing articles in magazines and newspapers very actively during that period of the 80s and the 70s, the 80s and the 90s. So we will find in the writings of Spencer and Huxley many clues to Sri Aurobindo's ideas, many sources of his interest. And then Bergson published Creative Evolution around 1907, I think, and his prior book on mind and matter, I think around 1893, around the same time that Sri Aurobindo became a professor of French in Baroda. And that work of Bergson led to the Nobel Prize in the 20s, sometime around 1928, I think. The work of Haeckel, Ernst Haeckel, correct my pronunciation if you like, was also published in the 1890s and the early decades of the 20th century. And Haeckel is the one philosopher of evolution whose work is actually cited by Sri Aurobindo and by the mother. And we'll look at some aspects of his thought. And so, the fact that Sri Aurobindo, the master of knowledge and yoga, made this exploration, this subject, a very prominent feature in his writings, and that at the same time, in biology and physics and psychology, it has been the most prominent common topic of exploration and study, means that for our civilization, and especially for our civilization here, if Whitehead is correct, this way of thinking, this emergent understanding, can be, or already is, the basis of the progress of civilization towards what it is and has to become. And so when I pose the proposition of creating a philosophy of evolution, what I mean is that we have the possibility of exploring an aspect of ourselves, of nature, of reality, in such a way that it forms the foundation of our civilization. Philosophy, according to Whitehead, is first of all the assemblage of ideas of importance. And an extraordinary aspect of the human consciousness is that it identifies those things which are important. It focuses on those things. It calls them values. And by focusing on ideas of importance, it decides, it selects where to put its energies. It defines and refines its project. And so in the various ages of the psychological development of the human being, you can see evidence of this pattern. The ideas of religion and of ethics and of law and of science and the organization of human communities are evidence of this assemblage of values and organizing society and the understanding of people around these values. And so the progress of civilization moves from structure to structure of commonly understood values. When Vladimir was speaking a while ago about consciousness being behind certain forms of expression, I'm sure that some of us at least recognized the theme of phenomenology there. Husserl's entire work was focused on discovering the intention, the intentionality behind the expressions of things. And he identified that possibility, the possibility of discovering the intentions of things, as a way of getting out of the conventional, rational, and scientific limitations of mind back to the origin, the original nature of things. And he called this realm of possible consciousness an intersubjective reality. And this is not the intersubjective reality of Habermas and sociology. It's a prior intersubjective reality. It assumes that there is a ground of being from which the nature of everything emanates. And so Whitehead then, in his philosophy, says that the other side of the exploration called philosophy is expression. There is the assemblage of ideas, experiences, realities, which is a kind of gathering of important thoughts, values, truths. And when they have been assembled, there is the possibility of expressing them. So for Whitehead, this is philosophy. Philosophy is the assembling and expressing of those things which are most important. We can call it contemplation and poetry also. And so he, among a few, relatively few modern philosophers, says that poetry is closely related to philosophy. But he says that philosophy has difficulty expressing the ideas that it assembles. The unity of ideas, the interconnectedness of ideas, the reality of those things which are most valuable. Philosophy struggles to express, but poetry, at its height, does exactly that. So as we pursue the assemblage of ideas of evolution, scientific and intuitive, we will pursue both of those streams. In the last 100 years, the intuitive stream, Bergson and Whitehead and Sri Aurobindo, has been very strong, and the scientific stream, the Darwinist stream, has also been very strong. And Sri Aurobindo says in his essays on evolution and materialism that these two streams have to converge, because the intuitive stream gives us a kind of ecstatic grasp of the interconnectedness of things, but it doesn't really tell us how that knowledge of the creative realm, that knowledge of inspiration, transmits its forms to the phenotypes of species, how those forms are communicated and embodied from age to age in a progressive way. While the scientific stream, which tracks incrementally the emergence of qualities and their progressive diversification in species, doesn't tell us anything about that realm of values and ideas and meaning, or not very much anyway. And so the scientific stream, which we're very familiar with, is able to deduce from ages of unfolding life forms their continuity. There's a continuum in body plans. There are very few. There's a finite number of body plans which have been evolving for a billion years. And now that that the so-called new synthesis in biology between genetics and adaptation and natural selection theories was accomplished, we see the connectedness on the genetic level of all of these species, but that genetic connectedness doesn't tell us how the transitions were made from species to species. It only gives us very, very sound evidence of the absolute unity and interconnectedness of all species. This is beyond question. And so if we follow Sri Aurobindo's thinking in the direction of solving the mind-body problem by the theory of the three worlds, the physical, the vital, and the mental, three worlds which are one world, and we come to understand that these are three levels of consciousness. There is the physical, there is the vital, and there is the mental. And they each have characteristic formations and expressions, but the carbon atom in the sugar molecule isn't aware of how it functions to help us achieve our aims. It is physical. The organization of procuring food and consuming food and reproducing itself, performed by the ants and the birds, obviously is a kind of intelligence, but it doesn't reveal any self-understanding of its process. So this process can be easily understood, except that we don't understand how it happens to be so intelligent and so precise, and how in the whole web of the life world, relationships are like that. They are intelligent and meaningful, but they don't give us any evidence of being mentally aware of anything. And so then mind somehow emerges within this context of matter and life as a self-awareness of the process, the processes. And as such, it is not separate from those processes. It is grounded in those processes. And so at the higher levels of mind, we have intuitive, creative, spiritual mind, and we have rational, analytic, and practical mind. And it understands itself well enough. So Sri Aurobindo solves the mind-body problem. But at the highest level of that emerging mentality, there is an intuitive grasp of Purusha and Prakriti, and of a creative mind above the rational mind, an overmind, and a higher mind, where Purusha and Prakriti are united. Science doesn't tell us anything about that so far. It's struggling in that direction. So Roger Penrose says that When mind evolves methods beyond its current methods, it will know these things. So there's an essay here about physics and biology that I'll also put on the internet, but some people who want to read are welcome to take this. These are some writings that I've been doing for years in this area. And in the back part, there are some pages on evolution that we will definitely discuss at some point. Sri Aurobindo then gives us a picture in which Purusha is not mind. Purusha is self. And Purusha can either be involved in the three worlds of mind, life, and body, concealed there, identified with those processes, or it can be detached and liberated and know itself as pure existence. And this is the Sankhya level of understanding of the complex. And then Sri Aurobindo tells us, beyond Sankhya, more from the Gita point of view, that this Purusha can also rise to that level of integration of the self and Prakriti. And so then we have the higher Prakriti, the Parampurusha, which is identified with all of those processes of the lower Prakriti, while at the same time being liberated and master. And so from Sri Aurobindo's point of view, then he says in a little book that you might also want to recall, The Riddle of This World. These are letters written in the early 30s, when he really has moved in the direction of the later life divine chapters. He says that the life plane, the vital plane, brings about evolution, the evolution of life, by pressing upon the material plane. So the life world presses upon and brings forward the vital processes that I mentioned a moment ago, the organization of life. And the mind plane presses upon the vital and physical complex to bring forth the mental forms of expression. And beyond that, the supramental presses upon the mental, vital, and physical space-time world to bring forth another type of organization. This is absolutely unique to Sri Aurobindo, as far as I can tell. As we look through some of the resources of the last 40 years, we find that Conrad Lorenz and Karl Popper and a few others have accepted the idea of the threefold complex, the mental, vital, and physical, each operating according to its own principles, but within a unified evolutionary context, is accepted now. And Conrad Lorenz received a Nobel Prize in biology in 1973. And in that same year, he published Mirrors of the Mind, or something like that. What? Yeah, maybe that's what it was. I have an excerpt from it in this packet, which I can't see. I'll tell you about it in a minute and read you a few lines from it. And so Sri Aurobindo announced in
let it be.
You think so?
As you will see when you read through these pages, and if you have already read through these writings and the supramental manifestation, you will know that Sri Aurobindo predicted that science would come to the point of recognizing this threefold nature of the natural world. And so some of the preeminent scientists of the last 40 years have done that. And in there are some passages from Fritz Capra, who speaks very explicitly about his philosophy of life being based upon the idea of autopoiesis, which is self-replication, the principle of self-replication. And all of the contemporary biologists agree that self-replication is the preeminent feature of life. And the idea of Prigogine of dissipative structures. All life maintains its form in continuity by the passage through it of energy. And this idea was articulated by Spencer in 1860. And so we can observe the development of that way of thinking, the more physical way of thinking. We can observe the development of the ideas of autopoietic thinking in Darwinian thought, in Darwinian biology. Self-replication is a key. And then Capra and Lorenz both add consciousness to the triad, and both say, as was being implied a while ago in some of Vladimir's comments, both say that the transmission at the cellular level and at the organismic level of impulses which lead to choices is in fact a mental process. And so Lorenz, for example, in 1973, long before Capra, says, the scientist sees man as a creature who owes his qualities and functions, including his highly developed powers of cognition, to evolution, that age-long process of genesis, in the course of which all organisms have come to terms with external reality and, as we say, adapt to it. This process is one of knowledge, for any adaptation to a particular circumstance of external reality presupposes that a measure of information about that circumstance has already been absorbed. And so today, the field of biological evolution is very closely related to the field of information technology. And the behavior of genes is interpreted in terms of information theory. And so this perception of Sri Aurobindo, of the threefold lower prakriti, is in fact being very widely accepted today. If we begin to assemble the earlier Darwinian ideas and the earlier spiritual and intuitive ideas of evolution, and follow their development through the early 20th century and the mid-20th century, when the synthesis of Darwinian and genetic thinking occurred, and then the latter 20th century up to the present, if we allow that field of development of ideas to organize itself in our consciousness, as the most important way of understanding reality. And if it begins to inspire us with a grasp of the nature of reality, and we begin to resonate with that large picture, then I think we approach Sri Aurobindo's idea that it's possible for human beings to become participants in the evolutionary process, to begin to interpret our own energies and actions in relation to the threefold prakriti around us as an active participation in that most fundamental reality, so that life begins to be very consciously the process of evolution, and not just a scientific awareness of why we believe that evolution is a reality. Our minds can easily believe that evolution is a reality based on all the evidence that's been accumulated, but that's mental. Our spiritual and devotional consciousness can easily feel that the divine force is descending, and somehow the world is going to miraculously evolve into some new reality. Some new divine reality is going to emerge miraculously sometime in the evolutionary future of the earth. And we feel it. We feel the potential that's there. And so someone asked on Saturday, so isn't it enough just to feel that force and surrender to it? And my response was, that's enough for the devotional approach. But the integral yoga is also a yoga of knowledge. And so at some point, we should expect to emerge another way of perceiving and energizing our reality, which is evolutionary. And that's what Gebser was talking about. That's what the integral consciousness holds, the possibility that it holds for the future. And so my proposition is that a philosophy of evolution, which doesn't yet exist, at best there are a few ideas from Lorenz, there are a few ideas from Ernst Mayr, there are a few ideas from Daniel Dennett that we can use. But for a philosophy of evolution to emerge, there has to be a philosophic intention, a process, an exploration, and ultimately the creation of an understanding of developmental psychology, Darwinian evolutionary theory, information theory, yoga, and creation, creativity, that comes from that understanding, an active pursuit of that understanding. So that's my proposition, is that we engage in exploring a philosophy of evolution. Comments? One possibility in a group like this is that some people will be especially interested in the work of someone like Lorenz and can assimilate and express, can assemble and express some of those ideas in a way that will be valuable to all of us. Some can do that with Herbert Spencer. Extraordinarily rich. Some can do that with Henri Bergson. Some can do that with Dawkins and Dennett, whose work I love, by the way. I think they're fantastic. I read a quote from Dennett on Saturday morning that I didn't bring today, but it said something like, "Darwinian thinking leads naturally to the supposition that consciousness will become capable of comprehension that is now incomprehensible to us." Darwinian thinking leads to that conclusion. And his most recent book, not his most recent book, but a culmination of Dennett's thought is expressed in a book called Freedom Evolves. And in Freedom Evolves, he destroys the notion of materialistic determinism. So one of the subjects that we will explore in depth, I hope, is the idea of determinism, both materialistic and spiritualistic determinism. We can explore in depth the possible relationships between the phenotype and the genotype, because this is still a huge mystery. If we can make some progress in understanding the relationship between the genotype and the phenotype, we will have performed something for humanity that will be extremely valuable. And so there are mysteries here still to be explored. And I think that a true philosophic method can explore those mysteries quite significantly and substantially. And so as we begin to have some understanding and some insight, we can share this through our website, and we can meet here with a progressing intersubjective awareness of what we're talking about and thinking about and comprehending in a hopefully a holistic and integrated way that's meaningful. We can create meaning which our civilization values. And so, you know, Whitehead's ideas, which were evolutionary from beginning to end, culminated in this message that this is a process that's very meaningful to civilization, and certainly Sri Aurobindo would agree, because he spent his life translating his spiritual experience into philosophic and poetic expression in order to elevate us. So we should engage that level of performance and gain some perspective for our own lives from it, at least. And I think everyone does that naturally by being here. So if we intensify it and focus on it, then we should become quite happy about the result. So, time's up.
In the course of the months there, we also talk about philosophies and so on that oppose that which you've just spoken about and which we have come to expand on.
Philosophy that
oppose to be absurd creationism, other aspects of Darwin, or Darwin doesn't have...
You know, there are actually no philosophies that oppose these ideas except in a very linear sense. You know, the... I think that the most unspiritual philosophies are possibly the biggest assets to our thinking. And Sri Aurobindo says in a very nice essay in this book on materialism exactly that. He says that the materialists are doing us a great service. Otherwise, we will float away in some idealistic notion of the evolution of the higher consciousness, and the meaning of the whole thing will just escape us. And so I'm very fascinated by the service that some of the most oppositional thinkers have provided throughout the centuries, and it has obviously been very stimulating, because evolutionary science is just booming in the world today, and as a result of its booming, it is asking the question: what is consciousness? And so in the last 10 years there have been hundreds of books published by scientists and psychologists and you know, physicists and biologists and so on, asking this question. Yeah, we can definitely entertain all perspectives on the question.
Well,
yes?
I have a feeling that you have been discussing the evolution of mankind as far as the species, of human species at large. And I was happy to know that we, as human, we can participate in this process. But in terms of how I am personally involved in the evolution, how can I, as a human exemplary, how can I actually work on my own evolution in order to be a real participant to this overall? So shall we go into this area too?
Let's do. You keep reminding us.
But that's typically yoga's dynamic psychology.
Yeah, it is. And in both this exploration and in the exploration of Sri Aurobindo's poetry, one of the one of the most interesting things to me about his consciousness, and one of the most difficult ones to really comprehend, is that he speaks from and about the universal vital plane and the universal mental plane. He's not speaking from the individual personal, mental, or vital. And he is speaking about the role of the liberated consciousness that is functioning on the universal vital plane and the universal mental plane. And the mother in her last years was speaking about the role of the person who acts on the universal physical plane. And so one of the steps that Sri Aurobindo recommends to us is that we stop thinking about mind as mental awareness, and we enter into an understanding, an active understanding of the self on all of these planes as a whole. And we interpret life experience in terms of the universal vital and the universal mental, and not as what this person says or that person does or how I feel right now about what you, about what, how you feel right now, and so on and so on. You know, this the expansion and elevation of consciousness that Sri Aurobindo's force suggests to us is possible and necessary is what's needed if we are going to arrive at a true philosophy of evolution or a true understanding of Sri Aurobindo's poetry. A true appreciation of Sri Aurobindo's poetry blows the stops of our normal perception and thinking. It's a very active, dynamic, and powerful understanding that is transmitted through his poetry. And so as I said on Saturday, quoting from Sri Aurobindo, it's not on the page. You don't understand Sri Aurobindo's poetry by reading the page. It's not there. It's in the sound. It's in the rhythmic sound. And so we explore that on Wednesday.
I have one question. I don't know if perhaps I missed it on Saturday, maybe you mentioned it earlier, but I was expecting to hear a little bit about a very focal word that Sri Aurobindo has used when he was talking about evolution. And I thought that concept was critical to the discussion, the concept of involution.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if we're going to bring that in later. Or
we have 12 weeks
exactly.
Ahead of us. two of the assigned the reading assignments for those 12 weeks are two chapters in the latter part of The Life Divine. You know, I don't know if everyone is aware of it or not, but in 1939, Sri Aurobindo added 450 pages to The Life Divine. And all of those chapters are concerned with the idea of evolution. And so there are two chapters which have evolution in their title, and then there's three chapters which have evolution in their title. And those three chapters are going to be recommended reading for sure. So, yes, the idea of involution and what it means and whether or not it could possibly be true or just a wild idea of Sri Aurobindo, you know, that has to be explored. For the purpose of this course, I'm not going to take anything that Sri Aurobindo said for granted. I think it's necessary to challenge both Charles Darwin and Sri Aurobindo. So that can be your special project, maybe. Does Ken Wilber really understand involution? So, you know, topics like that are kind of superficial, but they're there in the atmosphere. But the idea of involution has to be explored for sure. But I'm not going to make any kind of glib comment about it right now. People need to explore these questions. So then you come and tell us about involution. Please. We all want to know what it means. And so, you know, this cannot be a one-way street. You know, I have my ideas about all of these things, and I can provide a structure for exploration. But the exploration has to be our project.
Do you want to give another few recommended readings besides the three chapters?
Well,
I've
given some indications in these pages, which I'll also put on the internet. All the chapters in the Supramental Manifestation and other writings dealing with materialism and evolution are very rich, and I will bring some excerpts for us to discuss. We were also thinking of projecting here some quotations and doing a little bit of visual supplement to the discussion that we can reflect upon. But I have to warn you about these papers. One of them was written a couple of years ago, and I found it pretty unreadable myself today. There are some interesting references if you can manage to dig through it. And then in the latter pages on biology, that's much newer and not complete at all, but it sort of stops with the question, can we deconstruct some passages from Sri Aurobindo's comments on Darwin? And so we will try to deconstruct those comments at some point. But when that is going to happen, I can't really predict right now. There's also this long summary of the science of evolution from Jose Ayala, which is full of interesting ideas that can be put in the context of Sri Aurobindo's thought, or just looked at in terms of the pure scientific value of that material. It's extraordinary. So next time, how many people would like to have a copy of Ayala's scientific summary of the science of evolution? One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight. It's a 90-page thing. So I'll bring 10 copies along. I don't think I can put it on the internet because I think I would be violating copyright laws if I did that.
We don't want you to violate the copyright laws publicly, just do it privately.
Privately, right. Yeah, yeah. In India, it's okay to do it in general, but our website is worldwide, and I think someone would probably notice that this isn't altogether legitimate. Yeah, if you want to bring the 500 rupees also, then I'll know that you're in for the long haul, and I'll bring you photocopies every time.